today we are going to do a little Seahawks recap. We just came out of the bye with a 24/7 stone cold ass whooping of the New York Giants. We're going to touch on quite a few things today, including game notes, our hottest, spiciest takeaways from the game, our pants picks of the week in the Seahawks Twitter community. We're going to preview next week against the Houston Texans, which should be an awesome matchup instead of a couple of weeks.
Should be a good amount of pants pissing in there as well.
Lots of pants pissing, especially with Deshaun Watson coming to town.
Texans scare me, yeah.
And we're going to do a little state of the roster after that, and then we'll probably wrap it up with a little what we've been watching and chat about a little movies and television towards the end. But let's really dive into this. The Giants game was kind of a weird an enigma. Wrapped in something else.
So the Giants, I mean, they were obviously depleted. Their top three wide receivers didn't play. Probably their best pass rusher, Olivier Vernon, out of the game. Not a great roster. Otherwise, they got some talent, I think, in the secondary, Landon Collins. And did Janoris Jenkins even play? I don't even know. I didn't remember hearing his name at all.
He did play.
Did he play?
Yeah, I saw him kind of.
I just didn't hear his name. Posturing
over one of our players on the sideline at one point, kind of the generic Jenkins way.
At the beginning of the year, there was a lot of hope for the Giants as a good team, kind of a proven quarterback, even though he's pretty enigmatic, but a defense that has some pretty good pieces in place, some wide receiving core that looked to be improved with Brandon Marshall, Odell Beckham being one of the best in the league, and so they found a better quality number three receiver, one of the better ones probably also. However, they were not at full strength at all. Most teams aren't really at full strength this time of year, and the Seahawks put an absolute hurt on them defensively. It was not competitive.
They did offensively as well, and we just rewatched this game in like a little condensed version and kind of plowed through it. The offense dominated. Like, I know we can't get out of our own way when it really counts, and it's seemingly constant at this point that we just can't get out of our own way, but the offense racked up 400-plus yards, they had over 100 yards rushing. The run game, which we'll talk about a little bit later, looked pretty good. I mean, we just didn't use it consistently, so you never really got the chance to see anybody really break anything.
Yeah, you were getting backed up from penalties, and there were 15 penalties total that were accepted by the Giants against the Seahawks.
It felt largely self-inflicted.
Yeah, it really did. I think we'll start out with what we saw at the offensive line. It's the hot topic of every Seahawks fans watching experiences watching that offensive line. Effetti probably had his worst game. You pointed that out. I am a Jermaine Effetti apologist and a fan. I am a big Jermaine Effetti fan. It definitely was not his best game. I thought he had moments where he performed pretty well. I think just those, if you can eliminate the two false starts a game and limit it to like maybe one holding penalty a game, I can live with that.
He's a dramatically better run blocker too than Odhiambo is. So to run off the right side, you can see when he grades down one of those. He tackles and sets that edge. It is super impressive.
And he's not against bad players. He's been doing it against good players.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of hope for Effetti in the future. I think he's getting better. By any metric, he is getting better.
Absolutely.
Reese had his best game, I think, by far. That's two pretty solid performances in a row, I think, by Reese. He definitely had his moments against the Rams where it was not pretty at times. But the Rams have Robert Quinn. They have Aaron Donald. They have a bunch of really, really good players in that line. I thought he played himself well.
Yeah, he absolutely did. And maybe we can just, speaking of slurping, slurp Bobby Wagner and KJ Wright a little bit. They were incredible. I mean, especially just watching this again.
He dominated the football.
It was a hysterical clinic in tackling.
Yeah.
Just wrapping guys up, fools up, just dragging them to the ground. I mean, it was hilarious. No yak against those guys at all.
No.
Save for like one play on the sideline against Darkwa that KJ Wright missed. But other than that, I mean, it was incredible. The linebackers were so good.
Pete Carroll mentioned it on the his interview today, or on Monday with ESPN Radio that he does every Monday after a game. And he really did said that's really what they're all about. And they talked a bit about how they instruct tackling. It's it's hard to practice tackling in the NFL.
Right. And had a practice a year. They almost never go to the ground in practice.
But somehow, some way, they seem to really, really, really stress and make it the most important part of their defensive philosophy to hit with the shoulder, wrap up, and go to the ground. guys ready to get away. I mean, Wagner dominated the fourth quarter of that game. I mean, part of the reason was because Eli was throwing to the backs every time he was able to make plays. But
he literally never threw to a receiver.
But it was a caught ball, and it was one step, and the guy was on the ground. And it was not, and there was never a question. He was on top of those guys. He's the best middle linebacker in football, and it's not close at this point, I don't think.
It's not even close. I mean, everybody loves Kuechly. Kuechly
is a great player.
Literally going to die on the field if he continues to play. Like, he is the best. It's not even close. He's the most durable, and he won't get any credit for it either.
Probably not, especially with how good the rest of the defense is. But I do want to stick on the defense for a minute and go to my next standout. And he's again done it for two straight games. And almost under the radar is Jaron Reed. He's
Beef Reed,
as we come to call him. Beef Reed has been
Beef Reedman.
Beef Reed has been off the course in the middle. He was more than what you thought. I mean, looking at last year and the way he was fine last year. You know, he was solid against the run. He had some, you know, kind of slow, started slow and finished fine, I think, last year.
Yeah, I think so.
This year he's getting pushed in the pass rush. He's paired really well, I think, so far with Sheldon Richardson, who also had a really, really great game.
The interior of our line was insanely good.
They were very good. I mean, it's so he's developing into a player where he's really, really hard to block in our game. You have to double team him, and he's getting pushed in the pass game. And you combine him with Sheldon Richardson, Nas Jones. I think we're going to talk about it later on in the state of the roster. But you have three really, really great pieces that are young, that are guys that are all less than 26, 25 years old.
The last two drafts are looking incredible on day two.
Yeah.
The day two of the drafts are looking ridiculous. And I'm not going to throw up any under the bus by any means. I mean, he's got plenty of potential.
He's gonna get better.
Yeah. I really want to, you know, I think Reed had seven tackles, and then he had the strip sack fumble that DFC recovered as well. So, I mean, he was so impressive. And he and Richardson together, I think having Richardson, honestly, rather than having Ruben next to him, is a massive upgrade. Like a massive upgrade.
Yeah.
Not only in quality of player, but just in what he's learning.
I think so too.
I think it's pure technique too.
Yeah, it warms the heart to see a young player that you really need to have play well for you to be as good as you possibly could be. Does that make sense? It's awesome to see. It's awesome to see a guy play up to his potential.
It's
so often happens. Comes out of a program like Alabama, and you know Alabama's been tough on its players. And so guys get in the league, and even though they're great, you see it like in Reuben Foster right now. And I don't know if it's fair to say that's the University of Alabama's fault, but it seems to happen a lot more.
I think
with those programs. Yeah.
All for the glory of Nick Saban.
Yeah. Last thing about another young guy. Before we move on to hot takeaways, Ethan Posick looked like he belonged out there.
Yeah, he looked extremely good. And Glowinski didn't look bad by any means, but Posick just looked the part out there. Nobody really run blocked particularly well in the game. Ibushi in particular was very poor, but we called out two Posick run blocks that were very impressive in the third quarter.
Yeah, good position.
Sprung Rawls for like 9 and 7 yards. They were really, really solid.
Doesn't appear to be a mauler. That's not really his game. I think he's more about position, being smart. And one thing I really, really liked, I know Pro Football Focus said that he had no pressures given up in the game.
Right.
Great, great sign. But also when I saw him, how good he was, reacting to stunts.
Those kind of tricky defense calls when all of a sudden the guy that's over the center shoulder all of a sudden coming over your far shoulder. He reacted well to it, grabbed the guy, kept his feet moving and was able to kind of handle that without much problem. He's definitely put a lot of football in his life.
Yeah.
You can tell.
And let's touch, kind of before we get to the hot takeaways, like touch on the offense a little bit, because we talked a little bit about this beforehand, but Russ played really good. And what's crazy is he could have played way better, which is bizarre to say.
My favorite thing about Russ's game is I know he missed some. He airmailed a few over their heads.
Yeah.
There was two touchdowns that he flat out just missed with overthrows to Lockett and the Baldwin. But I do think that he definitely improved. And what I liked so much about his game was how quick he was with the decisions. He made his call and he threw the ball out there. It was decisive.
He moved around well when he had to.
He had a couple
not great sacks. That one in the first quarter was particularly tough to watch.
That was easily his worst one. The one where he kind of ran backwards like 12 yards and got sacked on like third and fourth.
Yeah.
That was brutal. You kind of have to live with those, and we've always had to live with those for us, right? I mean, he had another horrible intentional grounding as well that was completely on him. Although there was a really bad blocking scheme there, and Vanette was one-on-one with the DN,
yeah,
which was just silly in general. But
I think that was probably designed to get out a little bit quicker.
Yeah,
that was probably one you don't really want, you know, Jason Pierre-Paul to be on, you know, your third string tight end.
Right. Yeah, probably not
for longer than 3 or 4 seconds. But you know, that's stuff you live with Russell Wilson. He's gonna make great plays in those situations, and sometimes he's gonna get hit.
So. Yeah, absolutely. And some additional slurp for Dougie. I mean, honestly, he was just so ridiculous. Eli Apple talked a lot, like mad shit that game. He was all over these guys, and he got absolutely roasted multiple times by Doug.
He did.
He actually got roasted multiple times where Russ airmailed those throws too, one to Lockett and one to Doug, where he just vacated his zone and was just, there was no one there. Russ just missed him.
But yeah, I mean,
it just felt good because he's such an asshole. I'm sure he's a nice guy, probably.
His mom's nice. She seems cool.
Yeah. Last name is Apple.
Yeah. But I think Doug's, you know, proven out to be like one of the, you know, his stats say he's one of the best receivers in the league, and he is pretty much uncoverable one-on-one.
It's insane.
You saw it on his touchdown. It was how hard he burned the guy, how afraid of the guy covering him was to let him inside.
Yeah.
And, you know.
And then he did anyway.
Yeah.
He let him inside anyway.
Multiple times.
It was incredible.
Yeah. So it's he's been great this year, and it's good to see him kind of back in the full form. And he got by. Yeah. He did a lot of good, and that groin has given some problems over the last couple of games. So.
I mean, he just looked like himself.
Yeah.
And maybe that, once again, we have all of the unsung heroes who are better than 90% of this league on this team. Not going to get a ton of credit for it.
Yep.
But just giving an overall take on your state of the offense at this point, especially after rewatching that, because they certainly moved the ball.
The rewatch is important. I mean, I think, you know, I'll get to some of it in hot takeaways, but I think the line obviously is getting better. There's no two ways about it. I think it's obvious that. Things are starting to mesh a little bit better. People are starting to play a little more comfortable next to each other. It sucks that Joko went out, but if you can get this kind of play, consistent play out of
whatever combination of Lewinsky and Bosic, then there won't be a huge amount of drop-off. Odhiambo looked, you didn't notice him a lot, and that's because he was, for the most part, handling his business.
Yeah,
I don't think he's ever going to be a great run blocker. At least it would be a surprise if he was. He's not a huge guy.
Right.
You know, he goes about 6'4", 300 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
He's not really an earth mover next to someone that, like, compared to, like, a Fetty. And, you know, Kosick's a big guy.
Yeah.
And a Bucci. Me,
even Britt.
Yeah. Britt's a giant human being.
Yeah.
Too. You know, it's 6'6", 350.
It is nice to just see that amount of beef on the line for once.
Nothing wrong with seeing a lot of beef on that line.
I'm just saying.
I think that's helpful. Russell Wilson looked fleet of foot, looked good, looked fast when he ran. And
he's
like
healthy.
I said before, his decision making was very good. It was quick. You know, it's not always going to be the perfect decision, but making that call, especially giving your line some help by not holding the ball for 4 or 5 seconds every single time you drop back, it really does help.
Yeah.
Being decisive matters, I think, with this line. It was the same way in 2015 too.
Yeah.
When he had that scorching 7-game stretch.
Yeah. And he's on his best stretch, second best stretch of all time right now, 10 touchdown passes in a row.
That's there you go.
So we'll take it. Well, let's move on to my personal favorite segment, hot takeaways.
Hot takeaways. All right, I'm gonna let you lead the way.
All right, hot takeaway number one. We're gonna touch a little bit on the running game here. Although we didn't have a breakout runner, we had Rawls with the crazy fumble that led to really the only opportunity for the Giants to score.
Perfect hit on the ball.
Yes.
Arden
Rawls defender.
I'm a Paul Thomas Rawls apologist. I have him on my fantasy team. I've been holding on to him for the last 7 weeks, knowing that he's going to explode. And someday he will, I think, this season. He's just getting back there.
Yeah.
He's not quite there yet. I mean, Pete Carroll mentioned it again today. He looks really, really close in his eyes. And I know he's also a Thomas Rawls fan. I know he plays out of control. I think that's exactly what Pete likes about him. I think that's part of what makes him a really, really, you know, good runner when he's effective.
Yeah.
But there were some times there that he looked.
I think Brock called him spastic this morning when I was driving to work.
Yeah,
which He kind of is, but he always has been. Even when he was crushing it in 2015, he was spastic.
Yes, he is. He's a spastic runner. He needs carries, and yeah. I think they're just kind of getting him, getting his confidence up, getting him comfortable again. And at some point, he's going to take over a game at some point this season. That's not a terribly bold prediction.
Nobody did it last year. I mean, against Carolina, I was sitting in the stands for that game, and he had, in the playoff game, didn't he have like 160 yards against the Lions?
He might have.
It was something crazy like that, and a bunch of teeters. I mean, the guy is fully capable, but I actually think this is the first game where I legitimately, especially on the rewatch, went, oh shit, Andy Lacy's got nice feet in the backfield and actually looked like the guy they're hoping he'll look like, which is the guy that can get you 8 or 9 yards every once in a while and can bust his giant fat gut.
And in the meantime, get
some extra carries. I hope he doesn't listen to this.
Yeah, in the meantime, I don't think we're in terrible danger of Andy Lacy listening to our podcast yet. I agree. He had a lot of those nice kind of one cut, decisive runs, and that's what you need to have with this line. It's those holes are not going to stay open forever. They're not going to be
right.
It's not the Dallas Cowboys offensive line. There's going to be a crease. Trust what you see. Maybe trust it even though you don't see it.
Right.
Let it work. And that's the whole idea of the zone blocking scheme is that you run into some dark spaces sometimes, not knowing if there's a crease there, and all of a sudden, boom. The guard or the tackle makes the second level and blocks out the linebacker at the last second, and you have nothing but real estate in front of you.
Yeah. So, and I just think as a combo right now, since ProSec's played one play only to hurt himself again, I mean, it's not even worth mentioning at this point. Like, once you see the guy, I hope we see him because he's awesome, but good lord, dude. Like, one play when he was already questionable to play at all with an ankle injury, and then he tweaks his ankle again. Oh, but then it feels like McKissick needs more touches even. I don't know how they're going to get all these guys touches, but McKissick had 4 chunk plays in this game out of 6 touches.
CJ ProSize wasn't an Iron Man, was a tough football player. There'd be no room for McKissick on this roster.
Yeah.
I think that the only reason he's really there is because you needed insurance. You needed someone to fill that role.
Sure.
If you're going to be a significant part of the game plan and 8 touches in a game is a significant part of the game plan. That's probably where you were kind of targeting ProSize, 8 to 12, somewhere in there. So if that's part of your plan moving forward into a season, you need to make sure that if you have the luxury to do so, make sure that there's a guy on the roster that can do some of the things that ProSize can do.
Yeah.
And he can't do everything. ProSize is 225 pounds. He's, 6'1". He's a physical marvel. He's probably not quite as fast as McKissick or as sudden. But he
and run lots of wide receiver and
do some great things.
Yeah.
It's getting – it's. I mean, that if the organization isn't getting a little bit tired of
CJ ProSize, I wouldn't be surprised. I think they need to see him go play some ball when he's not doing his best. That's kind of the nature of the football.
He's a far end. I mean, we don't know what's going on.
I know. He could have, debilitating ankle issues at this point, but – good lord.
It's
tough. When you see Britt go down and then come back, and you see all these other guys go down and then come back in, Bennett getting his foot rewrapped 4 times in the game, you're just eventually you gotta show something.
All right. Moving on to hot takeaway number 2. We're going to talk to Jimmy Graham and the wide breadth of emotions regarding Jimmy's performance. It was, I definitely wrote some terrible things about him in our group thread. I won't repeat them because I'm not proud of them. He is a bit of a head case.
He's a total head case.
But you can see
it literally. You can see hit the wheel turning every time he drops a ball or catches one.
His sad eyes, everything.
He's got those beautiful doe eyes. He's such a hunk. How can you be mad at him?
He is a hunk. And I'll tell you what, though, as bad as it was, that drop in the end zone was, you got to make that catch.
Yeah.
And I know it's not ideal. It's not, right at your head level where you want it, but man, it hits you right in the belt.
You made the exact same catch later.
Yeah, he hits you right in the belt, and then that drop on the sideline when he was wide open and ready to run for another 15 yards, maybe more. That was the moment that I made physical threats for.
I think all of Seahawks Twitter was triggered at the same exact moment.
We'll get to that too later on.
Full on triggered.
Yeah, that was the moment that, at that point we were down, had we scored a field goal at that point?
I think it was 7-3.
7-3, and it was, the offense was rolling and that big a play happened right around the 50-yard line, and you're looking at the guy that's going to bring you into the, inside the 20-yard line. and he just fucking dropped it.
He had nothing but green grass in front of him, and it almost looked like the classic turn your head before you catch the ball type of thing.
Yeah, I think
Rawls did the same thing.
Started looking downfield, and that's going to happen, I guess, sometimes. But
when you're open by literally 30 yards in every direction.
Like, when you actually really needed it, like, it was a great play call. You were schemed wide open,
yeah.
And, like, all you had to do was catch the ball and just run straight ahead for another, 15 yards untouched. But, he did have a great catch down the middle of the field later on.
Three or four plays later, honestly. Offensive plays.
After the drive.
Yeah.
The next drive happened. I mean, it was good to see Russ go back to him. He really, really needed him to. I think if he had gone out of that game, having not been the last play that he was thinking about, it would have been a bad thing. I mean, you saw the way the team, Richard Sherman in particular, after his last touchdown to go up 24-7, the team rallying around him. I think,
jumping up and down.
Yeah, maybe we're reading too much into it. I don't think we are. I do think the team.
Never seen them do that with anyone else.
I do think the team seems to know that Richard Sherman in particular, that Jimmy needs a little bit more, sometimes needs a hand kind of getting out of the doldrums and feeling good. And if Jimmy's feeling good and Jimmy's playing good, I think it's.
Just look at it on that slant.
Yeah.
Slant was, they showed you everything you wanted to see from him.
The way he moves, how fluid he is for how big he is,
is
incredible. I mean, you saw Paul Richardson get tracked down from behind.
And just slammed on the ground.
From number 57, but Jimmy, in the same way, ran away from number 57 towards the sidelines. He straight up, I just outrun
him. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's...
he wasn't only faster, he was stronger than the guy, too.
The guy that can move that quickly, that, fluidly, is so rare. I mean, he is awesome to see out there when he's in the open field.
Yeah.
He needs to put it together for a whole game. He hasn't really done it yet.
No. He blocked pretty well in this game, too. Like, he's – they're almost there. Like, the offense, this – with the drop passes and then the missed passes, Russ legitimately could have had six touchdowns and they could have won this game 42-7 and Austin Davis would have gotten run in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, it could have been a complete blowout had Russ not missed a couple of those passes.
There was a lot of drops. I mean, legitimately bad ones, not just from Jimmy.
No.
So, I mean, hot takeaway number two is Jimmy's still a hunk. He's still really good. Like, just relax, people. Good God.
Yeah, it's that's gonna lead us into
our Pants Pisser of the Week.
Pants Pisser of the Week is my favorite segment of the show because there's just so much to pick from. And
this week was so great.
We're
gonna pick Mina Kimes eventually because she was a great Pants Pisser this week and made me laugh like no more than like six times.
She is a self-aware Pants Pisser.
Yeah, she is.
She'll comment about all the pants pissing and then she'll succumb to the pants pissing, which is this week. So. We're huge Mina Kimes fans here, but our Pants Pisser of the Week has got to be, and quite possibly the year. I mean, this was a special performance
It was incredible.
Yeah, by Davis Sue. Who's actually one of our favorite Twitter followers.
We love Davis.
We love him. He's a great level-headed. In most cases, he's very level-headed.
Never in the moment this time.
Except for
it was
the moment.
So funny though, and so great.
There were and it wasn't just one tweet that did it, because it rarely is a proper pants piss, just one tweet. It's a
tweet storm.
It's a tweet storm. It's a full experience.
And the offense gave us every reason to tweet storm.
Of course, yeah.
Davis has a lot of followers, and we're really engaged with his timeline anyway, so it's the first thing we see.
Yeah.
And following Jimmy's two drops was Rawls' drop on that screen pass that looked like, we'll wait to see the all-22, but it looked like, it was like a 3rd and 24.
There was accusations of mental illness. Yeah. They're both head cases. There was these kind of just crazy Trump style tweets where he's just like,
that was amazing.
Jimmy and Rawls, get out!
Get them out! Exclamation points, caps lock. It was incredible.
Yeah, saying that they were head cases, saying that Jimmy Graham is the worst tight end in football. And it's like, what? I mean, in what world? Like, I understand frustration, but he's not, I mean, name me a worst tight end. I would say Nick Bennett's a worst tight end.
Yeah, we have two on the team.
Yeah, exactly.
That are worse.
Yeah, and they're not even all that bad, I don't think. But
listen, I wish we could just do a podcast of me yelling during games. It would be the ultimate pants pisser.
No one likes it, not even me. And I watch every game with Ian. But
that's bullshit. I know you like it. Richard loves it.
Richard.
The podcast audience will be Richard eventually. I'm not sure what we'll have him on for.
He's
British.
Yeah, because he's. Nice lad.
Nice fella.
So that's the Pants Pisser
of the Week. Pants Pisser of the Week, Davis. Congratulations.
Yeah. And if you guys
get a plaque or something.
If you guys have seen any good pants pissing during a game, hit me up on the Nick James on Twitter.
Yeah, or at Ian Dins on Twitter. I love a good pants pisser.
Yeah, so just hit us up if you ever find it.
All right, well, let's not give him too much credence because he may
pit his pants. You know,
we got 10 games to go. So let's preview this upcoming week against the Houston Texans, which is coming off a bye. Houston Texans.
Yeah, what scares you?
I don't know. I suppose their receivers scare me because they actually have a quarterback now who throws to them, rather than throws to that tight end with the super duper long last name.
Fedorowicz.
Yeah, I think that's him. That's that new Adam Sandler movie on Netflix, Fedorowicz stories or something. What does scare me is Watson's really good, and DeAndre Hopkins has legitimately never had anyone that threw to him. Like, he was, like, the forgotten man in the NFL. He's so good. And they have a healthy Will Fuller.
Yeah.
Like, and Lamar Miller's a good running back. I mean,
Deontay Foreman. Their offense is good. I mean, Deontay Foreman's probably the best running back on the roster, and he's going to get more plays as it goes along.
Yeah.
He's waiting to have a game where he busts out. I mean, but
I don't think it'll be at the clink, but so
what scares me a bit is Jadeveon Clowney. He's not like a J.J. Watt type presence yet where he will just continually take over games, but he'll take over quarters at a time and just completely destroy drives. And he's exactly the kind of player that will give a guy like Reece Odhiambo problems or give Jermaine Ifedi problems.
They're going to chip him constantly.
He is an absolute freak out there. And he is not just a guy that will beat you around an edge. He will juke step to the outside and cut inside and inside of, a couple milliseconds, and he'll be destroying your quarterback.
Let's just say we're lucky that JJ's out and Cushing is doing roids. Cushing is a fucking douchebag. I'm just so incredibly happy that he got caught again.
Yeah,
he's such an a-hole.
The number one villain on Hard Knocks, and he was supposed to be some kind of hero too. He's built
just,
out and
just a dunce cap meathead, the classic Marshall bro. And then keep me honest, is Whitney Merciless out too?
Whitney Merciless is out for the year as well.
Yeah, so I mean, the defense actually doesn't scare me anymore.
Yeah, it's not like it did before.
They're safeties and corners are not particularly anyone to write home about.
The younger team,
younger
defense, with J.J. Watt being on the older side of things. But, they're definitely depleted, and we're going to get lucky again, I think, walking into a place. But, I mean, is it lucky to have stars out? Yeah, Whitney Merciless is a really,
yes,
good player.
Yes, it is lucky.
J.J. Watt's a really, really good player.
I mean, Cushing, for as big of a douche as he is good, too.
Also good. Yeah. But I think, it's – if any – the way the Seahawks defense played last week, shutting down, again, a depleted Giants team. But the way – it wasn't just the fact that they shut them down. They absolutely stifled them.
Three and out after three and out.
It was absolutely strangled. If you can make – if Watson's legs scare me a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit.
They scare me less, with, Bobby Wagner. And
it's not Kaepernick in his prime, though, who terrified us.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
and who legitimately burned us several times.
Yeah, ran a train on the entire league for a season and a half there.
Are there any GMs listening?
And, but yeah, I think the chances are good. We're going to probably have some scary moments in the game, but the way that defense is playing so confident, and I think seeing like Shaq Griffin and Justin Coleman, McDougal had a couple tough plays there, but
he was sort of thrust into the big nickel tight end cover guy role.
He's a good player.
He was their only player, and he surrendered two plays.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, Evan Ingram's going to make a lot of guys look bad.
And that touchdown catch, we both said it. He was literally fingertips away from knocking that off.
Yeah,
knocking that
right there.
It was the one good Eli throw the entire game.
Just a step late.
A lot of good Eli plays in that game. But, yeah. I mean, honestly, I don't think McDougal will play a lot of this. I bet we'll see Garvin. I bet we'll see Will play a lot. I don't think that Fedorowicz honestly necessitates.
I don't even know if he's playing. I think he's going to be.
Okay.
Yeah, I think he's out for. I think he's out for an extended period. He's on IR with the designation to return.
I mean, it just doesn't seem like there's a need for that.
Yeah.
And then when you have Watson as a rookie coming into CenturyLink, against a 4-2 team with a healthy defense, oh my God, he's going to be a fire.
One thing that I think you're going to want to look for is for that pressure up the middle. I mean, we've seen it for years and years with Russell Wilson. What's the best way to get a guy that to who can move it, especially a young quarterback, is to
get be freed.
Yeah, be freed. Sheldon Richardson, who again looked really, really great this week.
Yeah,
consistent pressure. That kind of leads into a bit to this segment I want to do. This
line.
It's called State of the Roster. And so the idea is every pod will every episode we'll sit down and we'll all kind of take a lead on discussing I think probably the current state and look how the future looks
for
a certain part of the roster. And we won't go too deep. I think we'll get a little more into salary cap as we go along and we work this out. But we're just going to pick the defensive line because it's a really, really interesting group at the moment. You have Cliff Averill obviously done for what looks like the year, probably.
He claims he wants to come back, but we'll see.
Yeah, so he's on IR with he could be returned, late in the year, probably like week 15 or 16. Mm-hmm. I think might be the earliest he'd be eligible to come back. He's got to be out at least 8 weeks.
Yep.
Very, very possible that he doesn't play football again. I think he's a very smart guy, thoughtful dude.
I'm sure
wants to come back and play with his team again, but if it's a long-term risk to his spine or his neck,
right.
That would give the toughest guys pause to come back. So, and if he just chooses not to, I mean, he was a great
guy. Good on him. He was amazing.
Yeah, he's a great guy. Class dude. I'm he's traveling with the team for all these games, strictly for the reason that he likes to have him out there.
Yeah.
So, which is says a lot about his character. Usually, guys that hurt like that don't travel with the team.
Exactly.
And he's bringing them along. Anyway. Michael Bennett, another guy, dealing with the plantar fasciitis, really great. I've never had it myself. I know people have had it, and it is
incredible that he's out there.
An excruciating condition on your feet. And he's out there working, tough guy that he is. But I think we're seeing, even if it is injury related, you're just seeing a decline in play from Michael Bennett.
Yeah.
As that's happening, we're seeing addition like Sheldon Richardson, who's that kind of interior player that you had with Michael Bennett for so many years. You're seeing a guy like Jaron Reed who's becoming a legitimate
force.
Yeah, three down defensive tackle, a guy that can actually get pressure up the middle, if not mean like incredible physical skills or being a great athlete, just good technique and wearing his opponent down. Frank Clark on the edge.
Detective
Frank Clark. Apologies, on the edge. Making great plays. Yeah, he didn't. I don't think he got a sack in this game. He did have a fumble on the recovery, but he was, consistently a problem on the edge, both coming around the corner, getting inside, and also stunts. I mean, he was getting Eli problems.
Yeah,
the reason that he didn't throw a pass longer than any air 12 yards the entire
game. Yeah, I mean, but Eli only got sacked once, and it was the strip sack, but he was under pressure well over three quarters of his dropback.
These guys aren't going to get sacks because people aren't going to get a lot of sacks because people are getting rid of the ball in 2 seconds.
Right. Nobody's holding the ball against this four.
They can't do it. They were getting consistent pressure, not just around on the edge, but up the middle.
Yeah.
And whether they were scheming that or they were just beating their guys one-on-one.
That and Eli just can't move. But still, I mean, it was perfect. It was a perfect game plan. At a couple points, they dropped 9 into coverage and only rushed 2, and they still got enough pressure that he had to put the ball out.
Yeah, exactly. So the defensive line in its current iteration, obviously it sucks to lose Averill, but moving forward, are we going to see, I think the question that I have is, with Sheldon Richardson being on this team, did you trade a second round pick for him and the Pro Bowl receiver Jermaine Kearse, what he's turned out to be apparently, did you trade?
When you have a quarterback like Josh McCown, you're going to catch balls.
did you trade for him just to trade a second round pick, a significant investment, just to let him go after this year? I know you get a third round comp pick, probably for a salary you can demand in the open market the following year. I'm sure they're going to take a look at him this year and see how he plays before they decide to extend him or not. But are we looking at a situation where if Averill retires, there's about $7 million up the top there? If you decide that let Michael Bennett go, you'd be probably $3 million in the top. I think that's it.
Yeah.
As far as his bonus goes, it would suck to lose those guys. Those guys have been face of the defense type players for this team. But as we know, the league is all about, what have you done for me lately? And if they feel like negative by shedding Bennett's contract, maybe that gives them the opportunity to re-sign Richardson and keep a guy who's in his mid-20s and entering the prime of his career with you for a long time. That's something you have to think about.
Yeah.
Frank Clark is going to demand probably over $12 million for an extension, just his physical ability and what he's done so far. He's a 10 sack guy.
Yeah,
he's not, to me, he's not a $12 million a year kind of player yet, because you need to be a guy that takes over games at this point, and he hasn't done a lot of that. He's getting there. It certainly seems like he's getting there to me.
Yeah,
but you know, this is a really, really unique time. I think that this we might be looking at if Sheldon shows out the rest of the year, if they
make a NFC Championship game or a Super Bowl, I mean, you have to reckon with that at some point.
Absolutely, you cannot hold on to Michael Bennett forever. You obviously can't hold on to Cliff Averill forever. And so, is this the year
is this the youth movement?
Yeah, is this the where it starts to turn? And you start
because it feels like it is, especially with Nas sitting back there as well and actually showing out pretty well. I mean, he's not. Jaren we're on a first name basis now. Beat Reed into me. But if Reed wasn't playing so good, Nas would be in there more. But Nas has shown great flashes in the first six games of the year.
He's been great. He's been good against the run. He's been disruptive in the passing game.
Brandon Jackson too.
Yeah.
I totally forgot about him. He was totally disruptive against the Giants.
Yeah,
and against the Rams.
Marcus Smith is
Marcus nice. Smith.
Yeah, so you have some young guys on the
I know, there's so many players.
Yeah,
they're all good.
Yeah,
oh my god, what a horrible situation to be in.
Yeah, they can actually play. So I think, moving forward, it should be interesting to watch. I would not want to see Bennett play for somebody else or leave the league. But it's times like this when guys start to break down. It's kind of what you think about. So anyway, enjoy the time we have with these guys with them at the time. But
absolutely
looking forward, and the defensive line is going to be be good for a long time with these young guys in place. It just might unfortunately affect the future with some of these guys that we've grown to really like.
Yeah, and I guess just enjoy it for the next the foreseeable future, at least the next 10 games, and maybe we'll get a miracle Averill recovery and get to enjoy it in its kind of full breath.
Orgasmic.
It's pretty orgasmic breath, yeah.
So let's move on to the next segment here. That's going to be what you're watching.
Yeah. So just to let the people know, we don't just watch and rewatch the Seahawks game every week. We watch a lot of other shit too. So we're going to talk about it.
TV. We're fairly boring.
Yeah. So we watch a lot of television shows.
Ian's
venture about them constantly.
He's a critic, a film critic as well, and is.
Yes. In my other life.
Yeah.
I write film reviews at drunksunshine.com and. As we do this pod, I'm going to kind of give people my thoughts on the movies I've been seeing and the stuff that's coming up that particular week. And it should be fun. I mean, there's a lot of stuff dropping this week as well. So we should probably touch a little bit on Stranger Things Season 2 and if we are excited for that.
I will give you a spoiler alert. I'm not excited for Stranger Things Season 2. I didn't watch Stranger Things Season 1.
What?
No, I didn't. Sorry. I'm not a hater. I don't know, but I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, sounds like you don't know. but I'm just going to touch on a couple movies that I saw in the last couple weeks. So Blade Runner 2049, which has been thoroughly litigated online at this point. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was one of Denis Villeneuve's best movies, to be quite honest. I thought he took an existing property that, to me, is a really hard property to adapt or add on to. Blade Runner is a very specific look and worldview and just point of view in general, and I think Villeneuve comported himself really well. In fact, one of my buddies messaged me and said, Blade Runner 2049 is the best movie Ridley Scott's ever made, and I go, Ridley Scott didn't make it, and he goes, I stand by it. I actually kind of appreciated it, but I actually think if Ridley Scott had made this now, it would have been terrible. Villeneuve has this very deliberate touch, and I think there's a lot of Kubrick in this film, and I was really, really impressed with what I saw. I honestly can't wait to see it again on the big screen. It's one of those stunning big screen movies that you really have to see.
It's one I'm kicking myself that I haven't watched yet, especially when we were going to talk about this. I am looking forward to it. I like moody kind of tone poem movies, especially when there's something behind it, kind of a big thought behind it, big questions behind it. Villeneuve's an awesome director. I mean, I rewatched Sicario at home a couple days ago. It's again, plenty of, I guess, action, if you want it to be, plenty of story, plenty of plot.
Yeah.
But really, honestly, it's the tone of that movie that really sets it apart. And if
yeah, the action's not overwhelming at all. It's very sparse, quite honestly.
Yeah, actually, but when it does happen, it's very...
It's very intense.
Yes, very, very intense. So, anyway, looking forward to seeing that. What
yeah, the second movie I saw last week was The Killing of a Sacred Deer, which is Yorgos Lanthimos's third film.
Yes.
This is starring Nicole Kidman, Colin Farrell, Alicia Silverstone makes an appearance in it as well, and the kid that played George in Dunkirk, whose name is escaping me right now. His name is, I hope I'm pronouncing his last name right, Barry Keoghan or Barry Keoghan. And this is a tough sit. I will say, the director has made two films previous to this, Dogtooth, which is an incredible, but avant-garde comedy, like, body horror, gross-out film. He followed that up with a movie called The Lobster, which was actually a very funny, heartwarming film with Colin Farrell. I believe that came out last year. So his third film... almost feels like a trilogy in many ways, tonally, is about this family that and Colin Farrell plays a doctor, a surgeon who has this very odd relationship with this young teenage boy, and you're not really sure why. It's not his son or anything like that. And it turns out that this he has operated on his dad in the past, and this son is not particularly happy with the way that turned out, and the movie gets very dark and very, very disturbing, and it has a really, really, really twisted sense of humor that I actually kind of appreciated. It lightened the mood in some very bizarre moments. I'm not sure I could recommend this film to particularly anyone. I'm not even sure I liked it very much, but I am really happy that it exists.
Sounds like it kind of stayed with you a bit.
Oh, it has, especially if you, oh my God, if you sat through it, it would stay with you too. I don't want to spoil anything, only to say if you want to subject yourself to the work of this disturbed man, by all means do. It's incredible. It's like almost lavishly well made. It was a contender for many awards at the Cannes Film Festival. It definitely has a perspective. I'm just not sure if I want to subject myself to.
Just want to sit with for a long time.
In any particular way or fashion. So
it's a classic Dinsmore review, like a well thought and well articulated. And I have no idea whether I should actually see it.
No, you shouldn't. I really don't think you should.
Well, I'm gonna go on to what I've been watching.
Yes.
What I've been watching with my wife at home has been Mindhunter, which is
puts me
with pretty large
with the entire internet.
Yeah, the entire internet, which is but it's for good reason. I mean,
yeah.
Mindhunter is I expected it was going to be kind of just an okay Netflix show like there are so many of out there. David Fincher notwithstanding, he's been doing this for 2 years developing the show. I'm not sure I love all of the casting.
Groff is the star. Kind of an odd choice. If everyone ever saw him on Looking, he's totally fine in the show.
Jonathan Groff,
yeah.
Kind of looks like a young, what the heck is his name from NYPD Blue?
Mark Paul Gosselaar.
No, David Caruso.
Kind of.
He kind of does. Only he's not ginger.
No, the show's great. The production value is, you know, is sky high. It looks terrific, like all David Fincher productions do. He directed the first two episodes. For those of you who don't know, it's I'll give a quick summation. It's two FBI agents, I believe, in the 70s that or 60s that go around a train police stations. Their primary job is they train different police departments, how to use kind of early profiling techniques, crime statistics, things like that. Along the way, they end up interviewing, you know, certain famous kind of historical serial killers of the day, serial killers, mass murderers. So it's kind of a macabre profile. It's those guys that really, really, in that kind of, I guess, repeating facet of the show that really make it the most effective. It's these people are obviously disturbed, scary people who present in a way that doesn't really glorify their crimes. Actually, it does quite the opposite. It shows you, gives you a peek in to the wide variety of personalities that make up, I guess, this really terrifying group of people. Some are very charming, confident, psychopath variety. Some are the sociopaths that can't function in society and are just scary from top to bottom. Anyway, it's, if you like crime stories, kind of psychological, kind of a psychological bent, it's a really, really good show to watch. I wouldn't say it's great, but it's been thoroughly satisfying.
Anything else? Anything else? We're
pretty much all been watching, outside of football and college.
Is that a 10-up run?
I'm through 6 episodes. I do want to say that there's probably 10 episodes left. Also, watch The Deuce. The Deuce is awesome.
Oh, yeah, The Deuce is incredible. I can totally back that up as well.
Watch The Deuce on HBO.
The Deuce on HBO. And two things that we'll probably touch on in episode 3. Mr. Robot season 3 is back, which I'm very excited for. I have 2 episodes of my DVR that I need to catch up with. And then thoughts on Stranger Things season 2. I'm so excited that it's back. It's just a really, really fun show that totally, uses, in quotation marks, its influences very heavily from the 1980s. Really, really relies strongly on the Amblin name. But I think it subverts it in a really fun way, and I think the kid actors are awesome, and it should be a really fun season to check out. So that's what we've been watching. That's Boss Hagen. I don't even know when you listen to this, so I won't drop the date. But we will be back, I believe, the week between the 2 home games. So between this Sunday against Houston and leading up into the Redskins game. We are watching getting boat raced right now by the Eagles. So
Eagles are scary, man.
This is gonna be a fun stretch. We got 4 of the next 6 at home, and it should be a lot of fun. So for Nick James, this is Ian Dinsmore. This has been Bob Hagen.
Not Doug, we Boss Hagen.
And a heavy hand. Why don't you come a little closer, my dear? Pour me a drink.